Another Virginia March ends early for the Cavaliers. The Hokies bow out of the NIT in the first round, and the ACC only advances one team past the first weekend of the Big Dance. It's a sad trombone kind of basketball episode, except for the Hokies women. This week on Teal and Barber. Welcome to episode 108 of Teal and Barber, the Richmond Times-Dispatch and Richmond.com's Virginia Tech, UVA, and ACC sports podcast. I'm Mike Barber, ACC beat writer for the paper, and joining me as always, my co-host, David Teal.
Mike, I hope your bracket's better than mine.
It's in the fireplace downstairs, so that'll tell you. David, if Pittsburgh could have just found a way to get it done against Xavier, I would have, for the first time in my life, had all four of my Final Four teams eliminated in the opening weekend. That's how I'm doing. I had Kansas, I had Arizona, I had Duke, and I had Xavier as my Final Four. So I'm on to spring training, baseball, and spring football.
Well, I too had Arizona, Duke, and Kansas, and our remaining Final Four teams are about to play one another. Because I had Texas and you have Xavier.
So for only one of us will be alive come the Sweet 16 or come the Elite Eight. That's pretty sad. Pretty sad showing from, again, a reminder that just because we do this for a living doesn't mean we have any idea what we're talking about when it comes to predicting. Although this March, David, I don't know who has any idea what to predict. It's been a wild tournament. You and I were both down there in Orlando. Certainly we're going to get into the specifics of what happened with Virginia, but how about the experience? How many tournaments in a row, or how many tournaments, NCAA tournaments for you is this?
42.
And I imagine it doesn't get old, right? I mean, being there, being courtside and the bands playing, it's I think my favorite assignment every year.
No, it's great. And the NCAA, for all the criticism it takes, and justifiably so, one thing it does superbly is run championships. And it does so for the media as well. And it is a privilege. And I use that word purposefully. It is a privilege to sit courtside for these games. It is so cool. And just it is a pinch me moment every season.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. Is no matter how many times I do it, I still look around and go, I can't believe I'm doing this. And you look at that little placard with your name there at your seat courtside, and you think, okay, it's not that I snuck down and I'm having a cool moment. I'm supposed to be here. That is pretty awesome. I had a good time in Orlando. I think as far as sights go, the warm weather was a big selling point. I ate some great meals down there. And David, as I get older, this becomes more important to me, but just a very easy to manage location. The hotel, was a block from all the restaurants and two blocks from the arena. That goes a long way for many reasons, but that being one of them, I wish my stay in Orlando had been a little longer.
That's why, Mike, I've always enjoyed Indianapolis, San Antonio, and New Orleans as Final Four destinations, because you can walk darn near everywhere.
Yeah, Indianapolis the year, and obviously we don't want to go back to, but the year they had the bubble, with even the faraway sites where we went, like Bloomington and Butler, I thought that was just an amazing atmosphere and experience, minus the real atmosphere, right? Which is fans and all the noise and all the I would love it if they did, and I don't know how many other cities could pull this off, maybe Chicago, pull off that bubble experience, but with all the fans and with all the bands and all the teams and nobody getting sent home early like VCU. And there's something to be said for that too, but it is pretty cool to spread out all over the country and get to take in basketball. I think it's part of why the whole country gets swept up in March Madness, right? It's like a concert tour, and it's coming to a city near you. I think that adds to the experience. It was a short experience, shorter than expected for us, but also for the University of Virginia, which lost in the first round yet again to Furman. David, let's start by diving into the game. which was fascinating. Going in, it was a matchup of two different styles, two different tempos, two different paces. Furman wanting to play fast, Virginia wanting to slow things down and grind. Furman looking to shoot in the first 10 to 12 seconds of the shot clock. Virginia looking to force them to take a shot late in the clock under duress. But all of those things, for all of that, the game itself, I thought in many ways, played to Virginia's advantage.
It did, Mike. There were 65 possessions in the game. That's a little quicker than Virginia would like to play. Virginia's average tempo is 61 and a half possessions a game. But the Cavaliers led by, was it 12?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, early in the second half. And that's a game you got to close. Yeah. There's just no two ways about it.
It's wild. And I thought Armand Franklin, when I talked to him in the locker room after, he kind of said it best, where he said, you know, that's what everybody loves about March Madness. You just don't think it's ever going to happen to you, right? Yeah. But that was the situation. Virginia finds itself up by two with the ball, closing seconds, a game that they had comfortably in control, had gotten tight, but it looked like they were going to pull through. And then, David, why don't you walk us through just the way this one ended? And if you haven't found the video online of Kevin Harlan and Stan Van Gundy and all their reaction,
and Dan Bonner,
who's a UVA alum, their reaction courtside calling that game. But David, walk us through. We got Virginia by two. They're inbounding the ball to their veteran point guard, Kihei Clark. And then
the unthinkable happens. Yeah. He gets trapped by two Furman defenders deep in his own backcourt, right there at the baseline. He's got a timeout in his pocket. The possession arrow does favor Furman, so I understand his desire to avoid a held ball. But still, you're up two, so a held ball is not the end of the world. Doesn't call timeout, doesn't end up with a held ball. Meanwhile, Furman's coach is screaming for his guys to foul. They don't hear him because the building is so loud. And, oh, by the way, did Furman's fans show out?
How about that?
Yes. And then Kihei Clark, just, he brain cramped. That's all you can say. And he throws the ball up toward half court, maybe thinking the clock would expire. You know, you've seen that play before, and everybody applauds it for how smart it is, but not nearly enough time had expired for that to work. Yes, Caden Shedrick was down there. And Shedrick, when I talked to him in the locker room, he was so interesting, and he's a fascinating young man. He's smart and very, I think, revealing. But he said he almost felt like a defensive back. Like he knew the other guy or a receiver, and he thought, okay, do I need to interfere with this guy and foul him to keep him from intercepting it? Because in Chedrick's mind, if Furman got off a three, they were going to win the game, because that's just how it was going. And Chedrick thought better of it, didn't foul, and sure enough, Furman picks off the very ill-advised pass. There's J.P. Pegues, who had been part of the trap on the baseline. He makes himself available, wide slam open on the right wing, and he buries it.
Yeah, and that's 68-67. And then Virginia does get to set up a final shot. Got a pretty decent look.
Yes, the play worked perfectly.
Yeah, got a decent look for Reese Beekman. It just didn't go down. But I got to go back to that Pegues shot in all of that, because I had a couple people tell me, it wasn't a great shot. It was wide open, right? There's no way, David, that in his mind he's thinking, I'm about to shoot a game-winning three. You mentioned he was just part of the trap. Mm-hmm. It's stunning. It stunned all of us the way it developed. So to me, that is, you know, an onions kind of shot, to quote Bill Raftery, to be ready to turn. And yes, it's an open shot, but to knock that down in that moment, I thought that was just that shot's going to be there. And unfortunately, so will that pass probably in the one shining moment montage.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no question about that. And it's a replay that will live on in tournament lore for quite some time. It is up there. Maybe only of all the wild finishes, Mike, I've seen in the tournament. You know, Grant Hill-Leitner is still number one. And then probably Lorenzo Charles's dunk at the buzzer to win it all for Jimmy V and NC State in 83. That was my first Final Four. And then that one may be number three, just in terms of that last sequence, just in the stunning nature of it. And like, this is not what I was expecting.
No, it was stunning. And, you know, I don't know if it matches gravitas for those other two in terms of being a first round. But yeah, it was stunning. And, you know, there was a symmetry, a sad poetry to the idea that, you know, Kihei Clark became maybe a bit of a national name with his freshman year pass to save Virginia against Purdue, right? In the Elite Eight, and Ty Jerome misses the free throw and Clark runs back and he's just a true freshman and he runs down the ball, takes a couple dribbles, makes such a smart and accurate pass to Mamadi Diakite. Diakite knocks down the game tying shot. They go on to overtime. They win in an overtime against Furman. They go on to win the national title. That was sort of Kihei Clark's birth on the national stage, if you will. And then to have the career go the way it does, and he's the ACC's all-time winningest player and all the records he has at Virginia. Granted, he had the extra year to do it, but you know, what a career, what an accomplishment. And then for his final run to end on a mental error by him, it was, you know, it's sort of nothing short of tragic and heartbreaking when you think about that kid.
Of all people, right?
Yeah.
He's the last one on that roster. You would have thought that would happen. If you miss a shot or you miss a free throw or commit a foul, okay, those things happen. But this was so completely out of character that it was beyond. And to think that young man then sat there in his locker stall and answered wave after wave of reporters coming up to ask about it. I admire him for it. I don't know that I could have done that, but wow, I appreciated his candor and the way he stood up to it, but you did. You just ached for the young man, not because you're a Virginia fan or anything like that. You just don't want anyone to ever feel that badly.
Yeah, and you know, as people were starting to trickle out of the locker room, I actually sat down next to him and recorder off, and I asked him about, you know, why did he stay? Why did he stay to answer our questions? He could have certainly hid in the shower for the 12 minutes that were left on the open locker room clock. And he said, you know, he told me, he said, hey, I talk to you every time we win. I got to talk to you when we lose. And I said, yeah, but it's your last one. And he said, you know, it's just part of basketball. And it was interesting to me because it's sort of the thing that I feel like sometimes UVA fans maybe get a little salty with Tony Bennett for. This sense of once the game's over, it's over. So many coaches come into the post game, right, David, and they're trying to relitigate what just happened as though they're going to change the outcome. And Tony Bennett, and I get why fans maybe wish he'd throw a chair or kick something over, yeah, or all that. You know, I get that. But Tony Bennett is one of the most competitive coaches in America. Kihei Clark is one of the most competitive players. They just have, and maybe Kihei's gotten some of this from Tony, a tremendous sense of perspective and a tremendous sense of, hey, when the game's over, the game's over. Life goes on, but you can talk about it. There's nothing you can do to change it. It doesn't mean it doesn't burn. It doesn't mean that, hey, right, we walked up to Kihei Clark, and what was he doing? He was watching replays of his turnover on his phone over and over and over. But you can lose with grace. You can lose with humility and dignity. And I don't think it means you're not competitive. And I thought that was part of what really impressed me with Kihei's response. Tony, there's been a lot of criticism of Tony Bennett since that defeat. It's another first round loss. Mm-hmm. Obviously, UMBC is the marquee, the headliner of that group. Ohio was a funky year in that Indianapolis bubble where they had been shut down during the ACCs because of Justin McCoy's COVID test. But it is also fair to say that other than winning a national championship, which, David, is a pretty big other than, this team has not advanced in March. You wrote a pretty passionate defense of Tony. What do you make of the criticism of Tony Bennett's system when it comes to March Madness?
I think it's fiction. I truly do. I mean, he's not only won a national championship, he took Virginia to its first Sweet 16 since 1995. He did that in 2014. Then he made an Elite Eight 2 years later. Yes, and that's a game they should have won. Hands down, should have beaten Syracuse. You've got that late lead. Need to close there. Did not. I give Virginia and Tony Bennett a complete hall pass on 2021. You don't practice but one time before Ohio because your team is quarantined due to contact tracing. That to me is irrelevant to the discussion. And then this past game, yes, you can bang on Tony Bennett for a lot of things in this game. The fact that it took them a handful of possessions to figure out how to attack Furman's zone, which granted they had not shown all year, so it's a surprise. But a veteran team and a veteran coach need to figure that out quicker than they did. Now, once they did, they were shredding it, but it bought Furman the time it needed. And then, Mike, you know, Virginia and Tony Bennett pride themselves on defense, but then they couldn't stop Jalen Slauson when it mattered. He scored 9 consecutive points for Furman to kind of ignite this comeback. And, you know, Jaden Gardner couldn't stop him. And, you know, that's on, you know, this was not on Kihei Clark. This was a collective breakdown of players and coaches. But, you know, in his career, by the way, Tony Bennett also took Washington State to a Sweet 16. Washington State hadn't advanced multiple rounds in an NCAA tournament since 1941 when Tony Bennett did it. So, you know, this notion that his style is ill-equipped for March, I don't buy. He's got a better winning percentage in March than Bob Huggins. And everybody wants to put Bob Huggins in the Hall of Fame, and that's all well and good. But guess what? Tony Bennett's better in March than Bob Huggins.
Yeah, there is some basketball truth to the idea that if you play low possession basketball, the games tend to be closer.
Yeah.
If games tend to be closer, they can have wild finishes.
Absolutely.
Get all that.
Yep.
But here's the number I come back to, David. Before Tony Bennett coached at Virginia, Virginia had plenty of basketball success. It had 0 national championships. Mm-hmm. Since Tony Bennett has gotten there, they've had even more success, and they've won a national championship. So to tell me that his style doesn't work in March when he's the guy that hung the banner, that just doesn't compute for me, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And I don't know why. Tony Bennett is one of the nicest people in college basketball. He is a genuine, you know, good person. I don't know why anytime they lose, especially in the national media, you see this narrative of, oh, Tony Bennett can't get it done in March. I remember walking down the hallway in Chicago after they blew that game, and they absolutely blew that game, the Syracuse.
Yes.
And I had a national reporter say to me, is he going to be on the hot seat? I said, I can't imagine with where this program was and where they are that he would be on the hot seat. And then fast forward to UMBC, and the same national reporter comes up to me and he says, how about now? He's got to be on the hot seat now. And I said, I just don't see it. I just, the way he wins, the way he carries that program, carries himself. I maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I have rose-colored glasses. I don't see it. Obviously, they go out the next year and win the national title. Now, that same reporter was not at our Orlando venues. And I don't know what his thinking was now. But now, what Tony Bennett has done at Virginia is outstanding. Yes, low possession basketball can lead to some crazy things. To me, some of these, this finish against Furman, you don't want it. And there were a lot of things that could have gone differently to avoid it. But I don't think it changes where the program is. David, let's talk about where the program is, because potentially this could be an even better team next season. Now, we don't know what Reese Beekman's going to do. When the year started, I had scouts telling me he was a low first round NBA draft pick, probably gone. Now his stock maybe has gone down a little. Maybe they can get him back. Armon Franklin has a decision to make. Caden Shedrick, who you mentioned in the locker room afterward, he certainly sounded like a kid who wanted to come back and do it again at Virginia. But things can always change. And the NIL deal, if somebody thinks, hey, Armon Franklin or Reese Beekman or Caden Shedrick is the missing piece for their program, could a bag of NIL cash change how things go? But you think about what they have. You think about how well Isaac McNeely and Ryan Dunn played as freshmen. You think about Isaac Trout and Leon Bond, who redshirted. You think about a talented class coming in. You think about Dante Harris, the point guard from Georgetown. David, this program seems positioned to be in the running to be very good again.
I certainly would think so. And as you mentioned, and very astutely, projecting rosters at this point is a fool's errand with the portal and NIL and the lure of, you know, not only the NBA, but other professional opportunities. So one never knows. But I imagine we will see Virginia hit the portal and bring in perhaps another big and see how that plays out. But I would expect to see Virginia and Duke and Miami and North Carolina right back at the top of the ACC next season.
You didn't mention Virginia Tech. And you and I both, I don't think I'm putting words in your mouth, had high expectations for Virginia Tech this season. It didn't happen. They struggled once again when they hit ACC play, didn't really ever get the ship righted, ended up in the NIT where they lost in the first round at Cincinnati to kind of cap off a disappointing season. David, what do we make of Mike Young's program, where they are, and maybe a little bit of what they're bringing back?
Well, everybody can come back, Mike, except for Mutz, correct?
I believe that's right.
Yeah, I mean, if Grant Basile and Hunter Couture decide to run it back again, sure, the Hokies could be up in the upper half of the ACC. What baffled me about this crew was, to a man, players, coaches, they all thought that this team might be as good or even better a shooting team as last season. Virginia Tech was third in the country in 3-point percentage, like in that 38-39% range. And this year they were wildly inconsistent, ended up at 35 and change percentage wise. They're like 80th or 90th in the country in 3-point percentage. That's not bad, but it's certainly not the caliber that they enjoyed a year ago. And the defense was never consistent either, as we saw in the ACC tournament. So it was just a group that never got its sea legs after the non-conference. You know, there they were, 11-1, heading into the ACC season. They had boat raced Dayton in Blacksburg, and Dayton had a good year. They had beaten Oklahoma State on a neutral floor. Oklahoma State did not get into the NCAA tournament, but was one of the last teams remaining on the board. Their only loss was to a very good Charleston team in the non-conference by 2 points on the road. And then all of a sudden they're 0-5. What were they? 0-7, right? Or no, 1-7 in the league, because they beat Carolina. That's right, in the ACC opener there in early December, and then lose 7 straight and never recovered.
Yeah, you know, I wrote about this after they got knocked out of the ACC tournament, but the players told me they felt like they had a really good team and they just never got it together. And that's strange, right? That's odd to have not be able to put it together when you have so many returning pieces and whatnot. And it was a puzzling season, and I still have a lot of confidence in Mike Young. I still have a lot of confidence in the pieces they have if they all do come back, but certainly a disappointing year. And David, a disappointing March, I would say, for the ACC. The league only got 5 teams into the tournament.
Second consecutive year.
Yeah, so downstretched, undeniably, at least in terms of that. Duke, very trendy pick after winning the ACCs. I had them in my Final Four on my bracket. They're knocked out in the second round. Pittsburgh, that was coming down the stretch, had a real good chance to win the ACCs. They won a play-in game, won another game, but lost to Xavier. They're out. NC State lost its first game to Creighton in round one. They're out. Virginia, we just covered at length. Miami, the only ACC team to advance. Now, Miami was the regular season champion and had a strong case to be considered the best team in the ACC, certainly. But to only have one moving on to the Sweet 16, it's not a great look for the ACC.
Well, it's not a great look for the ACC or the Big Ten. The Big Ten, which had eight teams in the field and only has Michigan State remaining. But what it goes to show two things, Mike, that the league is, the coaches' protests notwithstanding, not as good as it has been. It goes to show that the five teams last year that it then ended up, you know, having three in the Elite Eight and two in the Final Four with Duke and Carolina, you know, postseason success can mask a lot of things. This year, the league can't do that. Won't make that claim. And if Miami hadn't won the other day against Indiana, and boy, were they impressive in the second half, Miami, that is, the league would be without a regional semifinalist for the first time since 1979. It's 43 consecutive tournaments the league has had at least one Sweet 16 team, which is by far the longest streak in history, which tells you that ACC fans are spoiled, because this historically is the gold standard of college basketball conferences.
You mentioned the Big Ten, and for all that went poorly for the ACC, at least they didn't have a one seed upset by a 16 this year. Virginia, UMBC, they finally have some company in that historical stratosphere, if you will. I don't know if that's the right word for it. David, Fairleigh Dickinson, mm-hmm. Small school out of New Jersey, alma mater of former Hokies coach Seth Greenberg.
Right.
Stunned Purdue. And that's got to be the word, Purdue, and player of the year candidate Zach Edey, the 7-footer, just a matchup nightmare. I thought maybe Duke would be the only team that could really give them trouble because they had 2 7-footers they could throw at him. But here we are. Fairleigh Dickinson knocks Purdue out. That's going to be, no matter what happens the rest of the way, one of the most memorable things about this year's tournament.
Mike, Fairleigh Dickinson is the shortest team in the tournament. And they took down the big guy, Zach Edey. I mean, not to be cliche here, but that is truly David and Goliath stuff. And, oh, by the way, Fairleigh Dickinson didn't win its conference. The NEC, the Northeast Conference, Merrimack won the tournament, beat Fairleigh Dickinson in the final, but Merrimack gets bit by that NCAA transition rule that, you know, prohibits teams that are making that transition from being in the championships. And just like JMU football couldn't go to a bowl this past season, and Fairleigh Dickinson becomes the de facto NEC representative in the bracket and takes down Purdue. Just remarkable on so many levels.
It has been, you know, already a tournament full of upsets, which people could say what they want, but I think it makes it more fun, right?
Princeton, baby. Princeton's in the Sweet 16. That's cool.
It is a great year for Jersey basketball, even though Rutgers and Seton Hall are not part of that group. If I tell you New Jersey's having a great run in the NCAA tournament, I think you would assume that we're looking at Rutgers. We're looking at Seton Hall. We're not. We're looking at Princeton. You know, the old Pete Carrill days are back. And
right on the heels of St. Peter's last year, too, man.
It's the Garden State is a basketball state. David, with what's left in the field, and we mentioned I've got only Xavier in my Final Four. You have only Texas left in your Final Four. With what's left, if you get a do-over in the bracket, who do you like going forward now?
I really like Gonzaga. I think they're kind of been under the radar this season compared to previous Gonzaga teams. You know, it's Drew Timmy's last ride. I think they've got some business to settle with UCLA after how their previous or their most recent tournament encounter went down in the Indianapolis bubble. I like them, although, you know, Danny Hurley has UConn playing great, and they loom out there in the West. But I do like Gonzaga. I think the hardest region to pick, Mike, is that Midwest, where you've got darn near all chalk. You've got number one seed Houston, number two seed Texas, number three seed Xavier, and number five seed Miami. And they are all top 15 offensive efficiency teams. They are really, really gifted. And oh, by the way, Jim Larrañaga remains a wizard. And, you know, in the first round, you know, Miami was having all kinds of issues with Drake. And they're down with 6 minutes to go, and there's a situation where it looks like it's going to be a held ball. And the Miami kid, wanting to avoid the held ball, calls a timeout. And the camera panned to Larrañaga, and you could just see his head go down because he knew what the player didn't know. That was their last timeout. So he had to navigate those last 6 minutes without a timeout and with a deficit, and yet he and they managed to do it. And now he's got a program with one previous Sweet 16 appearance in its history before he arrived. This is their fourth on his watch. He is amazing.
Yeah, I think underappreciated what kind of a career he's had. In this area, probably cemented his legacy with that Mason run.
Yeah.
And look at what he's done since then to tell you how great of a coach Jim Larrañaga is. Well, a guy who's building up a reputation.
But one thing, if I could interrupt you, Mike, because I didn't want to avoid your question. So give me Gonzaga, give me Texas in the East. It's recency bias. I saw Tennessee with my own eyes play twice in Orlando. And, Mike, those dudes could play SEC football. They are that physical, that intimidating, that strong. And there's a reason they're the number one defensive efficiency team in the country. Izzo will be a trendy pick coming out of the East because, well, he's got 8 Final Fours. And that's 5th all time. But give me Tennessee there. And then I think it's Alabama. I still have questions. I wonder, but I think they'll beat San Diego State. And then that leaves them to play Creighton. I still think Alabama gets out of the South. Yeah. What about you? Who would your revised Final Four be?
I have not revised yet, but
okay.
And I'm not rooting for Alabama.
No, nor am I.
As I look over the bracket, it just feels like the Red Sea, the Crimson Sea, if you will, has parted a little bit for Alabama. All of those programs that you thought, okay, well, if they get to this point, they're in trouble. Or if they get to that point, it just seems like that's gone. From a rooting perspective, I don't know if rooting is the right word, but UConn and Michigan State are the two that maybe Xavier that are the three that I'll kind of have my eyes on. I like them. I like them going in. And now with the way things have shaken out, I think they've got some opportunity. But I think it's sad to say, but I feel like this is Alabama's tournament to lose in many ways. Although I do think Texas and Tennessee are both low seeds that have a very good chance as well. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's just weird to think there's no Duke, there's no Kansas, there's no Kentucky. So many of these brands that we're used to have been sent home.
Yeah, Mike, we could have the first Final Four since 1990 with no team that has previously won a national championship. That'd be pretty crazy.
They would. It's fun to think that there are these other programs arriving. I think the two upsets of 16 and ones in recent years tells you that the idea that parity is real and college basketball is deeper I think that proves it. You know, I don't think it's just numbers finally caught up with a one seed. The fact that it's happened twice, I think you're seeing just a depth of talent, how many good players are being developed in high school, in AAU, and all of that. And,
man, this is the third year in a row, Mike, that a 15 has made the regional semifinals. You got Princeton this year, St. Peter's last season, and Oral Roberts in the bubble in Indianapolis.
There's a real depth of talent that, that makes March Madness even crazier than maybe it was before. And March Madness, it isn't just the guys, David.
Right.
We've got the women. We've got Kenny Brooks's Virginia Tech team. We've got them just manhandling or womanhandling, however you want to call it, Chattanooga and South Dakota State, comfortable wins. Those are home at Castle. Really impressive. And now you've got a trip out way west, because it's the way the women's bracket works, to Seattle, where they're going to play one of the brand programs in Tennessee. David, what do we think of what they've done already, and what do we think their chances are going forward?
Well, first Sweet 16 for Virginia Tech, only the second in program history and first since 1999. So what Kenny Brooks and his staff and his players, Liz Kitley, Georgia A. Moore, and the rest have done is just exceptional. And wow, what a bracket awaits them out west, because if they beat Tennessee for the second consecutive time, because they beat them earlier in the regular season in Knoxville, by the way. So I don't think there's going to be any intimidation factor or any pedigree factor. I know, by the way, Tennessee's the team that beat them in the 1999 Sweet 16 in Greensboro, back when Pat Summitt was in her heyday. Tennessee was the three-time reigning national champion back then. But this Tennessee is not that Tennessee. And if the Hokies prevail, as I suspect they will, they're going to get UConn. In the regional final. Now, you talk about having to go through two of the storied programs in history to get to your first Final Four. Maybe you wouldn't want it any other way. Just go earn it. Go beat Tennessee. Go beat UConn. And leave no doubt that you belong at the Final Four.
Yeah, and look, Tennessee and UConn, there was a point where they were, you could pencil them into the Final Four. They're not at that level anymore, mm-mm, but they're still pretty darn good.
Oh, yeah.
These are still, and to your point, that there is, I think there is a triumph if you're a program that's trying to join that upper tier in going through some of those names. And certainly there are other teams now that if you get to the Final Four, you'll expect to see them there, and they will be tremendous obstacles. But a path of Tennessee and UConn out in Seattle to make it would be quite the accomplishment. Getting one of those two would be quite the accomplishment. And David, what they've done already is quite the accomplishment. I think it's really impressive. And I think Kenny Brooks, and we've talked about this before, not only does he have a team that's having a great season, but I think he's built something very sustainable in Blacksburg.
Sure feels like it. And Mike, it hasn't been one of those, you know, worst to first type deals in 1 year. This has been a very gradual, measured, purposeful build that Coach Brooks has done in Blacksburg. And that is what makes me think, to use your word, it is sustainable, because it's just not snapping your fingers, quick fix. I think he has the foundations in place to keep this going.
And we've both known Kenny for a long time.
Yep.
A lot of success when he took over the JMU women's program in not ideal circumstances.
Right.
Right. Got thrown into that. And the same thing, really gradually but steadily, built them up to being a pretty elite program with some of the biggest name players nationally, helping to elevate them, and then going on to the WNBA and now at Virginia Tech. It reminds me a lot of kind of what Bronco was doing at Virginia football, where every year there was another step, right? It was terrible, and then it was bowl eligible, but you get just decimated in the bowl game by Navy.
By Navy,
Yeah, and then it just seemed like until COVID kind of threw everything into a mess, every year there was another step. And since taking over for Dennis Wolf, that's what Kenny Brooks has been able to do at Virginia Tech. Is this the year for that step to be in Elite Eight or Final Four? I don't know, but I also don't see anything about this team, which is a one seed, that makes me say no, they can't be a Final Four team this year.
No, they've won 13 in a row, and they won the ACC tournament for the first time. They won the ACC tournament against a field that now includes four Sweet 16 teams. Notre Dame, Louisville, and Miami also headed to the regional semifinals. Miami, after knocking off top-seeded Indiana in its region, and we were talking about parity earlier in the men's game, and clearly there's not as much parity in the women's game, but this is the first time since 1998 that two number one seeds in the same tournament have failed to reach the regional semis, because Stanford got beat and now Indiana is out.
Yeah, for the longest time, with all due respect to some great programs, you could kind of pencil Tennessee, UConn, and Stanford into the Final Four. Jody Conrad's Texas team was up in there a bunch, and you kind of had a cluster of five or six teams that, that had a chance, and that number has grown as the women's game has grown, as the women's high school game has grown, AAU, support for college programs, smaller college programs, how much big programs are putting in. We've really seen a growth there, and it's making the women's tournament right up there in terms of excitement with the men's.
Yep, no doubt. And they're doing a really cool thing in Dallas to mark the 50th anniversary of Title IX. They are staging the Division II and III national championship games on the off day at the women's Final Four. So you'll have the women's semifinals on Friday. Then you'll have a doubleheader Saturday with the Division II and III national championship games. And then the women's Division I title game on Sunday. And that Division III national championship game pits two unbeatens in Transylvania of Kentucky and Christopher Newport here in the 757, where Mrs. Teal works in admissions. And their men this weekend followed up Randolph-Macon's D3 natty last year with one of its own. So Christopher Newport attempting to become the first Division III school ever to win the men's and women's national championship in the same season, which would be a just remarkable accomplishment.
That would be amazing. And I got to be honest, Transylvania of Kentucky sounds like a school that was made up, but I guess you get that sometimes at those levels. They are having an amazing run. Christopher Newport, their march has been amazing. We've got a lot of fun basketball, a lot of excitement ahead of us. Looking forward to talking about more of that in our next episode. Thanks for listening to this one. You can subscribe to Teal and Barber on Apple Podcasts, wherever you find your favorite pods. And please consider supporting local journalism with an online subscription to the Times-Dispatch. You can find special promotional offers available at richmond.com. Today's show was produced by Dean Hoffmeyer and yours truly. Teal and Barber is a podcast of the Richmond Times-Dispatch and richmond.com. For David Teal, I'm Mike Barber. Thanks for listening. Be healthy and safe. Rework those brackets. And please join David and me again next time.